Hi, welcome to our lunchtime date together with me, John Ballum. I am an organizational development consultant, I'm an educator, and I'm a coach with a passion for lifelong learning. With me today is my partner in crime, Gifty.
Hi everyone, I'm Gifty Parker, HR professional with a background in learning and development, performance management, as well as talent management.
So for the next 20 minutes, we invite you to sit back, find a glass of something nice, and enjoy an unusual conversation with us.
Okay, so here we are again, Gifty.
And here we are again, John. I'm really happy that we have the summer. I'm usually not a summer person, but when you look outside and you see the real sunshine, and you're really working so hard in a room, you're always inspired to go outside, finish it, go outside, right? So I give that to summer. It's really a great day today.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you know, some of our listeners might have the luxury of us like working virtually as well, and to step outside, and even if you're in an office, I think it's great to just step outside, eh? And to feel that sun on your body.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Always recommended, you know, just go outside and just take a break, even if it's a short break of stepping outside and get refreshed and then come back in. So I'm going to be doing just that after our podcast.
I'll let you go on time.
All right. So today, John, you've picked a beautiful, interesting topic. It's a build on a topic we had last year. Why don't you tell our listener the three areas that we're looking at? Why we're covering the second one? Perhaps we can give our previous listener and our new listener context in terms of what this topic is about.
Sure. So we are talking about ethics and ethics in organizations. And we titled this under the classical title, The Good, the True, and the Beautiful, okay? Because those three terms themselves form a nice overarching bracket, if you like, for what ethics is. And in summary, the good is about what is the purpose of our organization? Because to be good, we must have a really good purpose. I often say to people, you know, can you be an authentic Nazi? And yes, you can. Okay? Good authenticity alone is not enough. Authenticity just means an inner sense of coherence. You do what you say you're going to do. So if I'm a Nazi, I say I'm going to kill people and I kill them. You know, that's an authentic Nazi. But you can't be a good Nazi. Yeah, because the good implies something much more than living for ourselves and our own selfish desires and whatever else. So you've got to have a higher set of goods to aim for. After you've got that sorted and you have an idea of where we're going, what the purpose of our business is, you've then got to get down to the concrete reality of how do we make better ethical decisions? What frameworks do we use? We've got decisions to make. What principles do we use to base those decisions on? That would be the truth. So what is truth in organizations, essentially? And then finally, the beautiful, which we'll move on to next time, is organizational aesthetics and ergonomics. So how do we make our organizations appealing places for people to be in? You know, because beauty attracts us all and we want to be around it. We want to run from ugliness. And somehow, you know, these things got left behind. We make our homes beautiful, but sometimes our office spaces and our workspaces and our company is not so beautiful on the inside. So put those three together, you've got a cohesive framework. It can't exist without each other. Right? You can't have decision-making frameworks you don't know the purpose of your business, or say we want good things to happen in this company, we've got a good purpose. If the environment is ugly for people, all the rest around, you know, it's damaging people's lives, right? So they're all cohere and quite a neat cluster.
Yes, I agree. No, that's a good one. It kind of gives people an idea, especially those who are yet to listen to the first, the first section of these three combo areas. And they are all very vital for any organization. So not specifically a small, a medium, or a large, really, really a vital topic. So thank you for that, John.
Great.
And with our topic, we actually have five questions that we will be addressing today. You and I will be sharing our own experiences. And of course, we encourage our listeners to, you know, drop us some comments on what they think or what they've observed around our particular topic of today, around our topic on ethical decision making. All right. So the first question, John, would you like to go first, dive into the first question?
Okay. All right. Okay. So tell our listeners what it is.
Okay. So the first question is to share an example, so some examples of ethical and unethical decision making that we've witnessed in our organization, either a negative decision we've worked in or one that we've actually connected with.
Uh-huh. Okay. So I want to talk about one unethical decision that I saw in an organization, which really shocked me. Really, yeah, it was a huge shocker in my career to see this. So I'd just moved into the corporate world and was involved in corporate training and beginning to do some consulting. And I walked into a meeting of a senior board of executives. And I was about to start my presentation to them. I was giving them feedback for a climate survey we'd done. And the chairman stopped me. And he said, I just want to be clear on one thing. So, I thought it was something to do with my data. So I said, okay, what is it? And he said, you must understand that the data you share with us, we are going to tweak and change when we give it back to the employees. And, I was quite horrified. I understand very complex data. You might want to simplify some things in that sense, because not everybody's used to reading, complex statistical data. I understand that. But what he meant was where the news was bad, he wanted me to change the data.
Mm.
I couldn't believe it. The whole board was like, everybody was nodding their heads there. And I thought, no, because surely this will leak. There's eight people. And at some stage, somebody's going to tell their wife, somebody's going to be connected to somebody. Even if you don't have any ethics, you just do it out of purely fear. This is lying. It's lying at a very high level to your employees. Hmm. So, I was horrified. So I just said, no, and I'm sorry. I said, on the basis of that, I luckily had still retained the data. I mean, usually I release it before meetings to the executives so they can chew over and have a look, and then process it. But in this instance, I hadn't. It was just purely because I was quite new at the game. And I just had the data. I had it on all my server as well. And so I just canceled the contract there and then. And I'm sorry. I said, I'm sorry, unless you let release, you employed the wrong guy. But it was tough for me. Very big. So yeah, that's one. There's one. Hold up, just not team.
Yeah, I said that's a very good example. And we see today a lot of organization sometimes considering being gentle with the information that goes out to the employee given circumstances, but at least not to the degree of actually giving the wrong information because you want to come out in a positive light, right? I've had situation where we say, okay, maybe we don't say this way, we rephrase it so we're not causing anxiety or panic, but not to the degree of, okay, are we now changing the information and giving the wrong information? Then that, of course, becomes unethical, right? So when do we know when to actually stop? Because I call this a sugarcoating. When are you moving away from the truth and you're now going into something that does not necessarily give a picture of what the true situation is, right?
Yeah, because then we had stood up, and I stood up with the director and everything, and all the employees, you will see the result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. That's a very good example.
So you give me, have you seen stuff, good or bad? An example from you? I'll give a good example just now, but you've seen some stuff that has impressed you or horrified you?
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't really one that was horrifying. I think I will put this particular example I want to share to be one that happened during the time where people were quite unclear. So this was in crisis management. Now, I believe during the times of the crisis, for example, when we talk about the COVID-19 pandemic,
right,
it becomes really critical time for us to make a decision that will not only impact situation during the pandemic, but one that would be a long-lasting impact. So the pandemic was a very good example of where organizations needed to make ethical decision making in areas such as employee safety, customer welfare, even their supply chain management, but most importantly around vaccination. While it was very important for organizations to make ethical decision around safety, you know, public health safety, there were situations where there were unethical decisions around the context, around the intent, consequences. A good example was the violation of human rights. I had a lot of companies back then, most as a result of unawareness, had to were discriminating when it came to the vaccination, even when employees had a valuable or reasonable reason for not wanting to vaccinate, because the pandemic that happened recently, the COVID-19, was very new to a lot of people because all the pandemic happened generations way back. So people were making decisions without really researching to find out whether or not they were adhering to the human rights. So I had a set of employees who couldn't be vaccinated as a result of their beliefs. Others felt it was a violation of what they wanted to do, just a simple, my rights to my own body. The government at that time had not made the federal declaration for people to be vaccinated, but there were employers who, as a result of fear, made decisions to terminate people. And till today, some of those cases that I was involved with are still pending and still in court. So decision-making, especially when it comes to crisis management, should not be one that we take very, very lightly, because a lot of times we may be violating legal and regulatory requirement, and I've actually experienced that myself.
And you know, that brings me to round to that, you know, in our corporations and our organizations, we need sometimes to appoint ethical officers. We need people who specialize in ethics to establish bodies to make decisions, not just when we're in a crisis, but prior to the crisis. So we have well-oiled mechanism. Okay, we have a crisis, but we have a well-oiled mechanism. We have this body that can meet with people that at least one person there that has really studied ethic and these decision-making frameworks. And then, you know, we can sit down and we're not just all flying by the seat of our pants, right? Because there are certain protocols, which we will talk about just now, certain steps that you can take, you know, which everybody can take. And it's like a good heuristic. It puts you through a certain process, and at the, you'll get much better results at the end of a systematic process than you will if you just jump in and everybody's saying, well, my gut tells me, or, you know, I feel that. That's not good enough.
I agree. And we were talking about going with our gut. I mean, a lot of us still do that till today. And sometimes, you know, you may be very lucky to have that being the right decision that you've made, but we don't want to rely just on that. And you're very right. There's so many steps. You know, someone like myself, where I need to be accountable for any advice I give to clients, I always strive to ensure that every details I have that I want to use to make a decision is supported by data. So I love to promote that data-driven decision-making.
Exactly.
It's really so great. And it's the best way to be objective, right? Because we tend to want to say, oh, you know what, this is how I feel. But, you know, when it has to do with business, when a lot is at stake, you just don't want to rely on just your gut feeling. So for me, I've always thought about that. And, you know, today, having access, it's even easier with all this technology like ChatGPT, open access to libraries. So it's a lot easier. So I see no reason why business leaders cannot, you know, make the most of that.
Right. And so maybe it's a good time to, you know, I know we're going to jump our questions on our list here, but maybe it's a good time to talk about that.
Yeah. I think our question two says, what have you personally done to improve your decision-making process? I had during the, just right after the pandemic, I think one thing that I did with a client, and that was the first time we actually considered doing that, because during the crisis management, everyone had an opinion, everyone had a view. So whose opinion are we taking and what are we using to support the decision? We actually developed a decision-making framework for our particular organization. And very simply, it was just a way for them to be able to establish a clear decision-making process for their organization. So if we had a situation, a dilemma, we had a process that we go through to ensure we are able to make the right decision that incorporates all the stakeholders. So this example was one where we had to involve things like defining the decision-making criteria. We also helped this organization to consider alternate views, so it's alternate perspective, being able to assess the risk and potential impact. So these were some of those frameworks that were created for them so that if we have a situation, it allows for everybody to be able to share their input and allows for us to be objective, because we're not looking at just who said it, but we're looking at, you know, the different alternative in terms of the risk, in terms of the impact, and everybody was involved. So having this structured approach was very important to improve consistency in terms of how they made decision. It was able to ensure that their decisions were, most importantly, aligned with their goals and aligned with their values and involved all the stakeholders. It was the first time we created that. And that was because it was taking too long to make a decision. Those who were in the higher positions were favored in terms of what they had to contribute. So it was a beautiful framework. So that was what was helped. And now we encourage most clients to do that, especially our nonprofit organizations.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And, you know, those decision-making frameworks, we're going to talk in more depth about them, are critical.
Yes,
absolutely. Input on them, because we're not all experts in all areas. Yeah. For me, my big wake-up call was I'd been consulting for about six, seven years and continually, you know, in the consulting world, faced many, many ethical dilemmas from, you know, how I was to act or what authority I carried as a consultant or what authority my client was prepared to give me sometimes, which I thought was way too much, to make decisions about staff members and a whole bunch of things. And suddenly I found myself feeling a bit inarticulate. You know, I kind of knew some of this stuff and I practiced it. It was in my consciousness. But if you had to say to me why, I couldn't stand it out, right? You know, other than say I feel. When I realized that's not going to stand up in a court of law one day, if really gets messy here. Yeah. So I took myself off to do my master's in applied ethics and learn these frameworks. And I must say, it was like turning on the light. I was thinking, okay. And now I can justify or help people justify or learn how to, you know, research ethical problems properly.
Yeah, I agree. That's really nice. And you know that, your beautiful experience actually brings me back to something else that I always encourage. You know, organizations today, they leave very little room for learning and feedback. And learning, using your example of your studies and how that has enabled you to, I will use the word contribute, engage, it emphasizes the need to have a culture of learning, you know? And learning can be both from successes and failures. We can learn from what was good. We can also learn from what wasn't good. So we need to encourage people within the organization, stakeholders, to reflect on decisions that they've made. Oh, we made this decision. Even whether or not you have a decision-making framework, how well are you able to reflect on what decision you've made to identify areas of improvement? You know, even if you're successful, your decision was a successful one, we can always improve. If you're learning conscious, you will always consider ways you can improve those decisions or improve the impact, yeah? And share those lessons. We always have decision-making on one section of the organization, you know, have a centralized, but we need to decentralize that, right? And they share the feedback with everybody involved and let them know, oh, this is the lesson we've learned and actively seek feedback from employees. Oh, so this is what we did. We made the decision about the pandemic. This was some of the things that we've learned from this pandemic situation. What do you think? Or you can seek feedback as well while you were trying to make decisions. So your example is a true definition of what is required in today's workplaces.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it might be helpful if we just outline some of these frameworks for listeners, because they're very practical and listener could, like today, put this into effect when they have to actually think about, you know, whether they're making an ethical decision.
Yeah.
So the first framework is obviously the law, and that's international law, and then it's our national law as well.
Mm-hmm.
But just realize that the law is only the minimum. Right, is the bare minimum of what's expected of a decent human being. And it's based on a basis of do no harm. Yes. So you can still keep the law, but be a very immoral person.
What?
Right? Yeah. It can hurt a lot of people. But the law, nevertheless, because outside of that is criminality if we step outside the law. So we need a firm understanding, or we need to get expert opinion in some instances from legal professionals on what is the law. You know, there's that joke by one lawyer friend to me. He said, there's the law as lawyers understand it, and there's the law as the man on the street understands it. So some aspects of the law are very technical, and we need to make sure we fully understand, you know, because that's a minimum standard we're going to adhere to in all our business. And that's why, you know, I was famous when I was in organizations and leading them for, you know, bumping up the legal fees sometimes, because I would say, you know, people say, oh, no, we just do this. I said, no. You know, we bring our legal advisor in and we just check very carefully, you know, because what do you think might be the law again? So that's the one thing. The step after that, there are three frameworks. And the first one is what we call virtue ethics. So this goes back to Aristotle. And in essence, it means that it's the ethics or the morality of a particular community that keeps that community functional and flourishing. Okay, and that's the key word, functional and flourishing. So the decision I'm going to take, is it going to lead us becoming better people, or the organization becoming a better organization and all the connections it has? So if you can't say it leads to human flourishing, then maybe we must be thinking very carefully about what we're doing. I'll give you a practical example of this. One of the corporations I worked with in South Africa had a little poster up in all the elevators. And it had these simple words on it with a little graphic. It said, when you go home tonight, would you be proud to tell your children and your partner what you did at work today? Yeah? That's a beautiful question. Now, that's what we would call...
I agree.
Virtue ethics, okay? Very quickly, you know, it's like... the argument sometimes against pornography, you know, I have debates with people about pornography, and they say, yeah, it's great and everything. So I said, would you like to see your daughter in a porn movie? Oh, no. Well, you know, maybe else's daughter, Emily, but not yours. No. Okay. So it's that kind of thing, right? Is it really good for the whole community? So that's one of the first principles we talk about. That's called virtue ethics. So it's a community-based ethic. The community we live in, the community we work in, will this decision, what impact will it have?
Yeah.
Okay, another framework we can use in the fancy philosophical world, it's called deontology, but just unstrap the little Kantian ethics. And Kantian ethics simply says, this decision we're taking, logical. Now, what I mean by that, if I say it's okay to steal, then it must be okay for somebody to steal from me, but of which, of course, it's not, okay? So... bad ethics are fundamentally illogical, because the burden, the responsibility, or the weight of it, the cost, falls on the victim, not us. You see, that's what criminals do. They hurt other people, but not themselves, right? So if morality or ethics is fundamentally logical, it's got to be logical. Human beings must be treated as ends in themselves, not means to an end. And if people say, no, people are means to an end, well, I'd say, do you want to be treated as a means to an end in your organization? Or do you want to be treated with dignity? Oh, no, I want to be treated with human dignity. Well, morality's got to be logical. And if it's not logical, in other words, if it doesn't apply equally to me as equally to other people, then it actually isn't moral. So, you know, my mother had this down to a fine art, was to children, you know. What she'd do, my brother and I had to share like a piece of cake. She'd say to one of us, you cut the cake and the other person can choose which slice they have.
Yeah, we did that as well back in Africa. You split the, back then it was the meat, because everybody wanted a big portion of the meat. You
right.
split the meat, and then you're the last person to pick.
Exactly, you see. Exactly. That's Rawls as well. Rawls talks about being behind the curtain, a blind curtain of judgment when you make a decision, that we might end up with the consequences of that decision. So it's always got to apply to us, not just to others. Equal measure. That's called justice. We call this justice. And I love the thing about justice is that to be really just, it's got to be logical.
Yeah.
You share the burdens and the benefits of the decision. So that's another framework we can use when we look at decisions.
Thank you for sharing that, John. It's really helpful for people to sort of have an idea, you know, how should we have and look? How should we manage this? And it's also a decision even at the top level, every corner of the organization, whether the decision is something for immediate application or something that is for the long term, with a long term impact, we need to have a framework that works, that aligns with our organization.
Right. And I just want to go, there's one more framework to complete this. And that is what can be called pragmatism, but simply, or utilitarianism. And simply it means we do a calculation of what the decision we're going to take is going to do the greatest good for the greatest number with the least harm. Okay? The greatest good for the greatest number with the least harm possible. Because sometimes it's unavoidable. Some decisions come with, you know, we have to let a person go, for example. You know, it's going to hurt them, right? It's going to, you know, hurt the income stream. But how do we do that in a way which doesn't damage and smash up their identity, the least harm? So some decisions are hard decisions, and they do involve harm of some kind or other. How do we soften that? So to give you an example of really advanced HR practice in this regard, which I thought was phenomenal, when I worked in Belgium, I discovered that some companies there, and it was actually written into the law at that time, were not allowed to lay off people unless they had first found them another job. The company had helped them transition to another job. Only they were then allowed to lay them off.
I mean, a lot of organizations do practice that today, luckily. And I also feel like government as well are taking a big role in ensuring that, because employment standards in BC, for example, give organizations the alternative of giving a notice period or paying for a severance for employees who have maintained a certain tenure at the company. And these are, you know, great ways to ensure that, you know, we are able to create for people the opportunity to balance, you know, the current economy situation as they navigate different roles, and very ethical when it comes to decision making,
yes.
Laying off people. Yeah.
And then the last thing is just, it's an old one in business, but we must never walk past it, is product knowledge. So if you're in a manufacturing business, okay, all the people that work with that product must understand, for example, the environmental impact of the product, must understand how we dispose of that product in terms of recycling. They must have a keen knowledge of that, right? Because many people don't. So they work in organizations of these products, and they have no clue about how it's recycled or what's going to happen afterwards, you know, and they say, well, that's not my responsibility, that's engineers. No. It's everybody's responsibility to be aware of what we're doing. So knowledge, when you take decisions, I think, around products, for example, we've got to understand, like, put bluntly, the chemistry, the physics, the disposal, the whole bunch of stuff, the environmental impact of this product before we make decisions about how we're going to manufacture, where we're going to manufacture it. That's key to the ethical decision-making process too, and get expert opinion on it.
No, that's all. I absolutely agree. Thank you so much, John, for sharing that framework. I believe we somewhat have covered our question number 3, which is, you know, before organizations do make a decision, what are significant ethical implications? How should they prepare themselves and prepare their team? And we talked about that. We talked about promoting data-driven decision-making. Yes. Creating a decision-making framework is another good way, and of course, ensuring that legal and regulatory requirements are met at all times, especially in the context of Canada. There are several employment standards which are specific to different provinces. So ensuring that that is something that is aware. But one thing I want to have before I hand over a little bit to our question four and five is also ensuring that there is transparency and accountability when it comes to decision making. We need to move away from, people don't need to know the logic or the details the process of the decision making. No, we need to move away from that. We need to ensure that everyone, we have to strive to be transparent and accountable and responsive to the stakeholders. You know, questions, inquiries, we have that obligation to disclose information that helps them to be informed how to make a decision, especially if the decision is pertaining to the organization. They have every right to understand.
And you know, Wifty, that's a very powerful thing you've said there, because when I hear some senior managers say, oh no, but we can't disclose that because, you know, somebody then might pick that up legally and, you know, come back at us and stuff. Then I begin to say, well, how ethical was that decision? You know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And you're worried about being sued or whatever. Then how ethical really was that decision? You know, this old clause of keep your mouth shut and stuff, people getting their letters. I'm thinking, no. If it was that ethical, you wouldn't be saying shut up.
Yeah, sure. So brings us to question number four, Joe. This question is, I was thinking you can answer this one.
I did.
What are the basic, the basic framework. I suppose, to the last one then. Question number five. So John already talked about the basic framework people can use to evaluate ethical course of action. Question five is, how do you think an organization can develop more significant trust levels when communicating with internal and external stakeholders?
Yeah. So what do you think?
Oh, I was thinking I would throw that question at you.
I'm just being mean. Okay. So I think one of the things an organization can do is what you articulated just now so very well, is that they can fully justify using, you know, competent ethical frameworks, their decision that they made. You know, they don't just say we are, you know, they're able to say, this is a course of action we're going to take or we'd like to take. You can even ask for input from the organization and other stakeholders. I mean, I've seen organizations do this with their customers, ask their customers' opinions as well. And you can provide really good rationale and reasons. You know, and this can go from everything to the product knowledge on a bottle of sauce that's there, that it's honest. For example, if it's got gluten in it, it doesn't just say spices. It actually says, no, they've gluten in here, you know, or it's manufactured in a product in a company where gluten is contaminated. So there's a whole variety of things we can do, which are just putting it all out there truthfully to people. Because when you get a reputation for putting it all on the table, that kind of trust, you know, trust was built on factual knowledge or transactional knowledge. It's not saying trust me. The minute somebody says trust me, I'm like, no. And my question is, what must I trust? So really transparent communication processes, and then also with the option of people being able to ask questions and feel comfortable. And that's the other thing, you know, you can say, are there any questions? Of course, nobody's going to ask you a question but there's a place you can create a space where people, you can create places where people can come together and they can discuss something and they can ask questions.
You know, that brings me to, there was an organization I actually worked with, but this particular organization had this culture where you can never get an answer to a question. You could never get access to information. So it was really creating such toxic environment. And I would use this as a pointer in terms of our tips or our advice during this podcast. Businesses, and it doesn't have to be the leader, even you have access to information or you are able to give information, we have to strive to be responsive to stakeholders, internal or external. Things like inquiries, concern, feedback, they must be in a timely manner. Now, timely manner will differ from our situation to the other. But we need to make that clear. It's really important. because you want to create that space where people understand that communication, it's easily available and it's prompt and we can address issues. And if you don't have an answer, you also want to make that clear. Oh, that's something I can't respond to right now, but I do intend to look into it and give you an answer for it. So that transparency that we talked about, it becomes really important, even to very basic things like access to information and access to accurate information, right?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've also got to get clear in our minds, Gifty, what you said here, is what we mean when we say trust. So the highest level of trust is where we actually like associating with somebody. There's a strong degree of affiliation. We have a profound respect or respect based on knowledge of their technical competence. So, you know, my 13-year-old daughter comes to me and says, Dad, can I have the keys for the car? And I say, no, it's just, you don't trust me. I say, no. I trust you, you're a driver, and at least I love you very much as my daughter. But no, technically, I don't trust you to drive the car, right? Because you don't have the competencies yet. So I think we must, you know, sometimes we've got to help people understand when we have to say no, we have to buffer that sometimes and say, look, as a human being, I really like you. I really, you know, what we're doing, and I like being the business, you know. But in this instance, I need to get more knowledge. I need to have a better understanding, you know. So sometimes you get pressured. People come to us, for example, and say, okay, let's do this. And then, you know, and I say, why? And they say, no, it's a good idea. And then I say, no, I like you. Don't get me wrong. But I want to trust you based on some real factual data here. So give me the, like you were saying, Yuli, give me the data. And liking is not trusting in its most powerful sense of the word, you know. So when you communicate with external stakeholders, very important that.
No, that's absolutely right. Well, that brings us to the end of our podcast today.
It sure does. Sure, that was interesting. And yeah, thank you for sharing what you did. You know, just listening to you was really interesting, Gifty.
Yeah. Likewise, John, likewise. I always find this platform to be one where it's so powerful because we are not necessarily promoting an agenda, but sharing our own experiences with a wide network of people, what we've gone through, what we consider to be helpful to us, and hopefully encouraging people to open us to as well. So I'm actually using this as an opportunity to say to people, if there is any situation that you found where there was an unethical decision being made, feel free, or ethical decision being made, feel free to, you know, put a comment at the bottom of our podcast as we continuously promote that open space for us to have dialogue around an interesting topic today that we have on ethical decision and, of course, communication within the organization.
Yeah. So let's practice what we preach. We have to do this and ask each other, you know, what stood out for you today? What was your learning from this podcast? And I'll share mine with you just now.
I think what stood out to me today as we continue to talk is the fact that we need to continuously develop levels of trust when communicating, whether it's internally or externally, by listening to your example and even some of the things that we've touched upon. I just kind of found a common trend. And the common trend is, you know, it's something that is always going to be continuous. How are we developing the level of trust? The level of trust in terms of us and employee and those within the organization, employees and those outside of the organization, that stakeholders, how do we ensure that our efforts in promoting commitment to transparency, authentic and respectful communication, how can we ensure that this is at the level where we can say, okay, there is trust? And that involves continuously improving, continuously developing. Wow. I think that's one common trend I find. If we can practice that, even when you are out to make a decision that is unethical, you will probably have somebody that will openly tell you, oh, wait.
Uh-huh. Right? For me, it was, you know, when you spoke about data-driven decision-making and you talked about the pandemic and that special decision-making framework you developed during the pandemic to help clients. I really like that idea. You know, it goes very much in line with the models that I articulated as well, the whole idea that there are specific situations, and in those particularly crisis ones like that, we need to rapidly assemble clear decision-making process that makes it crystal clear for everybody what our policy is, and if they've got to, the managers have got to take decisions, you know, what we expect them to do, and they're able to then justify their decisions, even if they didn't have that knowledge before, that ethical decision-making knowledge. And now have, they can actually look employees in the face comfortably and not wriggle around and say, this is why we're making this decision. Yeah. But I like that very much. It's really helpful for people. Well, thanks, that was great.
That was great. Well, thank you for all the opportunity to learn and continuously improve ourselves, John. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. Okay. Thank you.
Till next week. Bye for now.
Until next time, this is Gifty Parker and John Barlam.
Remember, during your busy week ahead, stay good, stay true, and stay beautiful.
Bye-bye.